We started this series last week, and I talked a little bit of the background. That sermon's online. You can go grab that online. But we're studying the book of Esther, and we're using that as a lens to look at this idea of how you find your way through uncertain times. Last week was called Chaos is Coming, and this week is called A Time Such as This. And that's probably the most famous sentence from the book of Esther. If you know anything from Esther, you probably know that one. We'll be talking about that today. But just a real quick reset. We did the little cartoon that did a very good job of resetting where we are in the story. We will finish the cartoon over the next 2 weeks, so you can if you like the cartoon version better, just get here early enough to watch that. So Esther was an orphan, and she was basically hopeless, and her uncle, and we use the term loosely because it's some kind of a distant relative, named Mordecai, took her in, raised her as his own, adopted her as his own child, which is like happens three times in the Bible, and that's one of them. And she was very beautiful, the Bible tells us. And then the king, King Xerxes, who is the same king who will later march off to face King Leonidas in the Battle of 300, he had a fight with his wife, Queen Vashti. He deposed her, and so they had this big beauty contest, you know, Bachelor Persia, to pick the next queen, and Esther was chosen out of like 1,400 different virgins from all across the land of Persia, beautiful women, all of them, but she was chosen as the winner. And in fact, the interesting thing is that she was chosen out of the winner way ahead of schedule. They had, like I said, thousands of virgins there to be, you know, seen by the king. They'd all get their night with the king. And there was a movie that came out, in fact, a few years ago called One Night with the King. I don't know if any of you saw that. Not too bad. I mean, kind of follows mostly along with the Bible. They take some liberties, as they always do. But anyway, the interesting thing about that is they all had to take like 1 year to prepare for this. You know, they go through this preparations. They teach them how to, you know, behave like proper queenly ladies would behave. And so probably about one third of the way through is when he meets Esther. And he's, stop it, you know, it's over, she's won. I know who I want right now. And so, you know, we've done a lot of series here, they're kind of guy series. You know, we talk a lot about battles and wars and fighting and things. You know, I know some of you women can probably get tired of that. So I thought, you know, this is our one chance to kind of, you know, do a little bit more feminine-like sermon. It's not my specialty, but I thought, you know, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. Let's go ahead and show the wedding as well here. So the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins. So about one third of the way through the proceedings, he says, nope, she's the one I want. And so he picks her to be the queen. Now, that's not just the queen like one of his wives, one of his many wives. He's actually going to make her queen regent, and he's going to put the crown upon her head. So he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti.
Your queen!
From One Night with a King, if you haven't seen it. So that's where we are. That's where it's set up. And that could be the end of the story of Esther, but this is just the beginning of the story of Esther. It's kind of a rags-to-riches story. In fact, the One Night with a King takes some license with it, makes it pretty romantic. From what we know of Xerxes, that may or may not have been true. He seemed to be a pretty cruel man. But anyways, it could be that. You know, kind of a Disney fairy tale come true, you know, almost like a Cinderella story, you know, where she becomes the queen. But the Bible just getting started. Now, it's going to set the stage here a little bit here, because what happens when this is picked, because it's like halfway through or one third of the way through, the king decides to make a big pageant out of it, and he brings all the virgins out for one more lap around the kingdom and kind of show them all off one more time, you know. And, you know, these are all the women from The Bachelor, you know, it's like the before the rose ceremony, whatever they call that thing. This is what they're doing. They're bringing them all out, and they're going to show them all off so all the kingdom can see the beautiful women. And then they're going to announce Queen Vashti. And so Mordecai, who is, you know, her uncle, but like really feels like her father, is worried sick about her because he does not know what happened to her from the moment she was taken to the palace. And so he's standing there and he's waiting. He's trying to see, and he can't send a message to her because nobody knows that she's related to him in any way. They've kept that a secret. The Bible says Esther's kept a secret, her family background and nationality, because Mordecai told her to do that. says, don't tell anybody you're Jewish, because Jewish people were not held in high regard at all. They were a conquered people, and they were very low on the social ladder. Don't tell people who you are. And so while Mordecai is sitting there trying to catch a glimpse of her, they're trying to see if Esther's okay, he overhears a plot to kill the king. And this is one of the many times you'll see in the book of Esther that God's hand steps in, but they never announce it as God's hand, because clearly this whole thing was brought about for this moment so that he could hear this. And he gets word to Esther, I don't know, through a messaging system or through another person. And then she goes to the king and tells him about it. And so, she says, this man named Mordecai told me about this plot. And so they investigate the plot and they find out it was true. And the NASB Bible here kind of makes this soft, and then they hang them. The older texts say they impaled them, which is probably what they did when they found them, so they killed them. And then this whole thing gets written down in the book of Chronicles. That's not our book of Chronicles. That's the Persian book of Chronicles in the king's presence. And that's one of these things that the Esther's author does. It's like he throws something in there and like, we'll come back to that later. You know, and so we'll come back to that one later. But so this kind of sets some things up. Some things are moving, and we see there's some political intrigue. Now, for the next couple of chapters of Esther, we see a King Xerxes who's kind of a little bit absent. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Historically, he's probably preparing his invasion of Greece at this time. So I just think he's just caught up in all the many things that goes on. It's a very long supply line. It's not easy to, you know, conquer lands. And so he's planning all that. And so you see him a little bit pulled back now from the story. He's kind of an absentee king a little bit. And in fact, because of that, I believe he will take this man named Haman, and he's going to exalt him. He's going to say, you know, you handle the minutiae of running the kingdom here. You just take care of that. So he had to pick somebody. He probably killed the other guys who could have been picked. So he picks somebody else. He says, I'm going to make you like me. You're going to be my regent. You're going to speak for me. And he actually gives him all the powers of the king. It says that he says everybody's even supposed to kneel down when he walks by and give him honor because the king commanded it. So, you know, it's all set up now. You take care of this so the king can focus on, you know, his invasion plans. You know, conquering the world takes a lot of time. So he has to go do that. What he's done is he's given a lot of power to a little man. You know, we see Haman as this very, very kind of evil man. He's very small, in fact, not in stature probably, but in his personality. And you know what happens when a little man gets a little power. It goes straight to his head. One other thing I think I should mention is that the Jews, which love the story of Esther, still have every year a feast called Purim. And Purim is the feast of Esther. And in that, when they tell the story of Esther, the Jewish kids, every time the word Haman is said, his name, they hiss. You know, so he's like this bad guy, you know, this Snidely Whiplash or whatever. You know, he's like the villain of Jewish culture. So, you know, he's a bad guy. And so I believe, and I'll tell you why I believe this, he went beyond what the king said. In other words, not just bow down as I walk by. I believe he actually set up a statue of himself. And so he was always there, and they were to bow down to the statue when they walked by. And Mordecai was not going to do that. And so when Mordecai would see that, he says, yeah, I'm not doing that. And he would not bow down or pay him honor. Now, the reason that I think this is actually an image of him instead of the actual person is because Haman doesn't know this is going on. He has no idea. And that tells me it was something more than just his person. It was an image of his person that they were supposed to bow down to. And that's kind of significant because in the Bible, you'll see Jews bow down to kings. They were allowed to do that according to their culture and according to their laws. You'll see Daniel do that to Nebuchadnezzar. Oh, great Nebuchadnezzar, he bows down. May the king live forever. You know, the honorary title. But they won't do it to graven images, because that's when we get into that you shall not worship idols part, and they say we won't do it. And so we start seeing a glimpse, even though Esther's author, you know, we talked about this last week, deliberately left all glimpses of God out because the Persians would have never put it in their library if he'd had that in there. He leaves it out, but you start to see this kind of thing start coming through, because what Mordecai does at this moment is identical to what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do. It's identical. He says, no, I'm not going to bow down to graven image. And they ask him why. All the little, you know, little guys who are working in the palace, all the little like sycophants, they're like, why are you not doing this? And so they ask him. And day after day, they spoke to him. And he refused to comply. And then they said, well, let's go find out if it's okay with Haman. So they go to him and they say, look, is it okay he doesn't do this because he's a Jew? So he told them why. He says, I can't do that. I'm Jewish. And Jewish people cannot bow down to another altar. We just can't do that. And so they went running. I think they're probably all thinking about converting. Well, this is cool. If I get out doing all this becoming Jew, let me do that. And that's when we find out that Haman first hears that Mordecai wasn't doing it. That's why I don't think it was his person. If it was his person, he would have noticed it when he walked by. I think it was actually a graven image. And so when he hears about it, he is angry. You know, you're not allowed to do this. I'm an important man. You know, you can almost hear this high, squeaky voice. I'm important. You can't do this. And so, you know, he said, you can't do this. But he disdained to just lay hands on Mordecai. He says, you know what? I'm going to kill his whole race. He said, I'm going to destroy all the Jews, all the people of Mordecai throughout the entire kingdom. That is a lot of people, by the way. Because they were taken by the Babylonians, and then the Syrians came in and took them off. The Persians came in and took them. And so some of them were allowed to go back home at this point. You can go back to Jerusalem. There's a book in the Bible right around Esther, Nehemiah, where Nehemiah goes back to rebuild the wall around Jerusalem. And Ezra, the prophet, returns home. There were a lot of people, even in Daniel's day, who returned home. So they got scattered throughout the kingdom. You know, the Jews were all over. They don't have a land, so they've taken up residences in other lands. And Mordecai says, I'm going to get them all. Haman said, I'm going to get them all. He said, I'm not just going to take down Mordecai and whoever his families are here. I'm going to wipe them all out. I'm going to use this as a way of destroying all Jews. And what he does not know is the moment he said that, he kind of sealed his hand, because God has promised that can't happen. You know, he's promised the Jews, that's not going to happen. And so what happens next is he decides this is going to be a lofty undertaking. He's going to exterminate hundreds of thousands of people. He's going to need a plan. So he goes to the various Persian magic men, you know, the soothsayers and the Chaldeans. And he goes to them and says, when's the best time for me to pull off the genocide of an entire nation? So they cast lots for him, and they come down to it, and they said, we're going to do it on the 13th day of the 12th month. Happy birthday. Stephanie and I share that birthday. December 13th was when the Jews were meant to be exterminated. It's my birthday too. It's like, wow, what a great birthday present that would be. I'm going to exterminate all the Jews on my birthday. I can remember that forever. So that's his plan. So now he's got the whole plan in place. You know, he's got the backing of the priests and the Chaldeans and the mystics of Persia. Now he goes before Xerxes to launch his plan. He's thought carefully about this. He's got everything laid out. And watch how he approaches him. He says, King, there's a certain people. He doesn't tell him who. There's a certain people among you. They're dispersed, and they do not observe your laws. Now, that's a scary thing, by the way, when you're a king getting ready to invade another country. You really can't have somebody behind you causing trouble. And this is what he's insinuating. They're not listening to your laws. We can't trust them. You're getting ready to march off to battle. You can't trust these people behind you. So it's really not in your best interest to let them stay here, he says. And so if it's pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they will be destroyed. So he's got his attention at this point. But that's a costly proposition, killing hundreds of thousands of people. How are you going to pull such a thing off? And right now, you can bet Xerxes is counting every drachma, because he does not know exactly how he's going to afford this long conquest against the Greeks. Of course, if he knew how it was going to end, he'd really not know how he's going to afford it. But, you know, he's kind of counting all of his money, and Haman says, don't worry, man, I've got that covered too. You know, in fact, I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business. And then they'll end up putting all the plunder back into the king's treasury. This is a no-lose proposition for you. By the way, this has kind of probably been somewhere between $600,000 and like $1.2 million of his own money that he's going to pay for this. I mean, he wants them bad. So actually, you know, clearly Haman had worked his way up, and he was a very wealthy man. And so he said, I'll pay to do this, because I just, you know, think this is really has to be done. And so the king says, well, that's a good idea then. You know, you're going to pay for this, and on the plunder, you know, I'll get a percentage of that back. Okay, what's not to like about this idea? So go ahead. And so he does. He takes off his signet ring, and he gives it to him, which basically says, you now act as me. You can write whatever letters you need to, pass whatever laws you need to in order to make this happen, because this is not going to be a small thing. This is going to take a lot of planning in order to kill them all off. And so he goes off with his little ring, and he comes up with all this. He's got all these ideas. He's putting in all his plans in motion, and right now it looks like he's going to successfully wipe out all Jerusalem. So stick a pin in that for a second. I'm going to go back to where this whole thing started, because it starts way, way, way before the story of Esther. Way back in 1 Samuel is when this story starts. You know, a tale as old as time here. Because there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of a Benjamite, which you have to be in the tribe of Benjamin, a mighty man of valor, and he had a son whose name was Saul. So this was the first king of Israel, Saul. You know, you may have remembered we talked about this guy a little while ago. And so Samuel comes to him and anoints him as king. He's the first king, and he has a couple little skirmishes, and he unites the people. And once the people are united, then Samuel comes back with his first command from the Lord. He comes back and says, okay, I need you to go wipe out the Amalekites. And the reason why he's against them is because when his people were leaving Egypt in Exodus, this guy harassed them all the way. He would attack them and he would steal things, and Moses was always having to fight this guy off. And God promised, when we get settled in the promised land and in the future, we're going to wipe them out. And so now that he had a king in place, he said, this is your first task as king. I want you to wipe them off the face of the earth. Destroy them utterly. And this is something God does a couple times in the Bible, and it's a little bit uncomfortable for us, but he said, kill every man, woman, and child. Wipe them out. I don't even want you to keep their plunder. I want you to destroy the flocks as well. Everything that's in the battle, you take, you defeat them. And so he's outnumbered, Saul's outnumbered, but God's with him, and he has this mighty victory. And so he goes ahead and defeats them. But he stops short of doing exactly what God said. Because as he's looking at all the flocks there, and by the way, this isn't like all the flocks. Right? This is the flocks that they would have brought to support their army. You know, they always did that. They brought food. He's looking at some really good sheep, you know, and some really good cattle. And he's thinking, you know, we'll kill the bad ones. But the good ones I think we should keep. And all the people love that, because the reason you went to war in those days was for plunder. And so we can't just wipe everything out. No one has any plunder. And then he looks at the king and thought, why would I kill him? He takes him alive, and he says, I just don't think I need to kill him because I can ransom him. And that was always, by the way, the biggest money you got out of a one battle. If you got the king alive, you could ransom him back to his people. They'd empty the treasury to get him back. So he's like, you know, I'm going to go ahead and do this. So he went forward. He took God's promise of victory. He took that. And then once he got God's victory, he says, I'm going to back out of the deal. I'm not going to give you everything, God, but I'll give you a lot of it. And then God comes to Samuel and says, I'm done with Saul. That fast, he says, that's it. If he cannot obey me, I don't need him. I need a king who's going to obey me, and so I'm not going to keep him as king. And that's how David ends up getting chosen. So he goes to him and he says, you know, go tell him he's done. And so Samuel goes and delivers the news. You did not listen to the Lord. It's over. You're no longer his king. You've got to listen to the Lord. You can't just take God with you to the victory. You've got to obey him. And so that was that. Now let me show you how this connects. When we first saw Mordecai in Esther chapter 2, they introduced him like this. In the citadel of Susa, there was a Jew named Mordecai, a descendant of the son of Kish. He's like great-great-great-great-grandson of King Saul. Right? So this is King Saul's grandson. Now let me show you how this Haman got introduced, because you may have missed it. He was the son of this guy who is an Agagite. That is a descendant of King Agag, who was the Amalekite king. So basically, this is a descendant of the king Saul was supposed to kill, and a descendant of Saul. And here they are again. 649 years later, all of a sudden the descendant of Saul has to deal with a problem that Saul created 600 years ago. Here's the point. Our willful disobedience will always have consequences. And we have to understand that. And you know, I talked about this before. God's grace is real. God's grace saves you from God's judgment. But it does not save us from consequences. There's two different things. There's judgment, there's consequence. So we're saved from judgment. We're not saved from consequence. If you murder somebody and then get saved, that doesn't mean you don't have to go to prison, right? There's consequences to our sin. And we have to understand there's consequences to our sin that sometimes we want to try to get out of. Oh, I'm saved now, so I don't have to worry about my sin. I can do whatever I want. That's not how it works. In fact, in Colossians, Paul tells us, he who does wrong will receive the consequences of the wrong which he has done, and that without partiality. He says, you're not getting out of this. The consequences still have. And what you have to understand is some of our sins, especially this kind of sin, we're talking about Saul, it's not just you that pays the price. God tells us that he will not leave the guilty unpunished, and it goes from the children, children's children. Three generations, sin gets passed down. We have to understand that when we willfully disobey God, we are literally passing a curse down to our children and our grandchildren. That's what the Bible says. We don't like to talk about that. It makes us uncomfortable. But I'm not just talking about sin. I'm talking about willful disobedience. I'm talking about when you know exactly what God tells you to do. You definitely know what's right and wrong here. And you say, I don't care. I know what's right and I know what I'm doing is wrong. I don't care. I'm just going to do it anyway. Because as long as I get away with it, I'm okay. You know, right and wrong is not determined by whether you get away with it or not. But it seems to be there's grown up a culture that believes everything I get away with is right. And that's not the Bible. And the Bible says, if you're willfully disobeying me, there will be consequences, not just in your life, but in your children's life and in your grandchildren's life. And we have to understand we're passing down sin to our children. And believe me, I know it because I'm talking to some people now. And I'll be talking to them about things going on in their lives. And then I'll find out what's going on in their parents' lives. And oftentimes I'll find out what's going on in their grandparents' lives. I'm thinking, holy cow. This is generational. It's established generationally, and it's the biblical principle, but people don't want to believe it. So we have to understand that we need to be godly ancestors for our children and our children's children. We need to do that. When Saul comes when Samuel comes up to Saul, and he tells him, hey, God told you to destroy everything, Saul's excuse is, but I'm paying God. I've got all kind of good stuff here. I'm going to pay God. As long as I give him 10%, he's okay, right? I can do everything I want as long as I give God money, because I know he likes money. I'm going to give him 10%. I'm going to give him the best 10% he's ever had. How can he possibly be angry with me? You know, go rob a bank, give 10% of it to God, and it's all okay. It doesn't matter what we do. As long as we give God his 10%, God's cool with it. And Samuel says this, no, that's not how it works. You know what God delights in? Not your offerings. He delights your heart obeying him. And you're listening to his voice. And then he says this, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed God is better than the best of the offerings. In fact, rebellion is the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is like idolatry. And this is something we just don't seem to think. You know, our sin's not that bad. Okay, I'm a little stubborn. But God knows that. He's okay with that. This is what God is saying about your stubbornness. He said, it is like idolatry. It's like you're getting on your knees and worshiping another god. That's how I see it. And that rebellion, you might as well be, you know, a Persian Chaldean witch. Because that's how I'm viewing this. Because what you're telling me is I don't matter in your life. You're going to make up your own mind. That is idolatry, by the way. You've put yourself on the throne. So poor Mordecai, 649 years later, is going to have to finish what Saul should have done. He's going to have to. The difference is Saul was a king with an army. He's practically a prisoner with nothing. So this isn't even fair, but now Mordecai's got to clean up Saul's mess. And letters got sent out then to all the different couriers, and they sent this out. This plan was put in place that on this date, you know, plan it, get your people in place, and on this date, we're all going to attack the Jews at one time. We're going to wipe them out. They're never going to see it coming. Complete blindside. We're just going to wipe them out. And so they sent it out to all the different prefects and things in the different areas. Gather your people up. We'll pay you for your special Jew extermination army. And when we give the word go on December 13th, you kill them all. And so they're making all these plans. But somehow, again, God's hand works in. Mordecai gets a copy of that letter. Now, he shouldn't have because he was known to be a Jew. You know, obviously they weren't telling Jews what was going to happen on December 13th. They wanted them to be totally surprised. And so, you know, but somehow Mordecai gets a copy of it. And when he gets a copy of it, he goes into mourning. Now, this is something that was given to them in Leviticus. Again, you see Mordecai's heart and you see his training here because he tears his clothes, he puts on sackcloth, he rubs ashes in his head, and he goes into mourning. This is the same thing David did, and we see this in their places of the Bible. Here's the problem. When you're mourning, you have to stay out of the sight of the king because apparently mourners creep out Persian kings. And I don't know why exactly, but we see this. We see this in the Bible. We see it in Nehemiah. When Nehemiah, who was very well favored by the king, is serving him wine, and the king sees him and says, why is your face sad, though you're not sick? This is nothing but the sadness of the heart. Oh my gosh, you're mourning. And in fact, he says, then I was very much afraid. These kings do not like people coming into their presence mourning. And so Mordecai was not permitted to go into the city gates. So there's like three gates that deal here. One's around the city of Susa. And then you get closer, and then there's the gate that around the palace, which is usually where he was, but he wasn't allowed past that gate. And then there was another gate inside that was to the king's throne room. So like three gates going on here they talk about. So he goes as far as he can, right up to the gate of the king, and he starts wailing and crying. And there's only one reason he's doing that. He's trying to get Esther's attention. And he gets it. And she goes, shh, you got to be quiet. What are you doing, Mordecai? So she sends somebody out with clothes. Put clothes on him. The king cannot see him mourning. You know, freaks them out. You cannot let them see you. And so she sends these clothes out, and he won't take them. He says, you know, I'm like this for a reason, Esther. You can't just put clothes on me and pretend like it's going to go away. This is a serious problem. It's not going to go away. And so she summons a guy, and she says, okay, you go find out what he wants. Tell him, ask what's going on. So this guy goes out, and he tells him everything. He says, Haman has promised to repay the king's treasuries for the destruction of all Jews. And then, just in case she didn't believe him, he actually had a copy of the letter itself. And he gives the letter to her and says, okay, take this to her, and you show her what's going to happen. Now, what she needs to do, because she's the queen, and she needs to go talk to the king and stop this madness. There's a problem. She was the queen, but she was Xerxes' queen. And we saw that Xerxes could yank a queen out and throw her away. He's done it before. And Esther actually really has a message back down. And she says, Mordecai, you know better than this. You know that no man or woman can come to the king's inner court unless he calls for them. Can't do that. Unless I call for them, they're not allowed in, he said. No one. There's one law, and that is you put them to death. If I walk into the king's courtroom without an invitation in my hand, I'm dead. The only thing that can possibly happen is if he sees me, he might hold out a gold scepter, and then the guards will let me pass alive. If he does nothing, I'm dead. There's only one way through. The king has to literally say, it's okay. If he ignores her, she's dead. If she says, guards, she's dead. He said, you don't understand. And here's something else you don't understand. I may be the queen, but I haven't been there for 30 days. You know, this is the queen that he loved. You know, he got her because he was missing his other queen. She was clearly a favorite of his. She hadn't been there for 30 days. I believe he's just heads down at this point planning his invasion. He doesn't have time for anything else. Barely eating. He's trying to get this all worked out. And she goes, I can't just go in there. That's not going to work. And so she sends that message back to Mordecai. This poor eunuch's running back and forth now. And so she tells him all that. And then Mordecai gives this reply back. And this is a very famous reply. This is, like I said, if you know anything about Esther, if you paid attention during the Vacation Bible School or CCD class, for those of you who were Catholic, you probably know this line because this is very famous from the book of Esther. Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. You think you're safe in the palace? If word gets out that you're Jew, they'll come for you too. You don't understand. This is systematic, and throughout the whole kingdom, they hate us. And they're going to come for us, and they'll find out you're Jew, and they'll come for you too. But that's not even the most important part. He goes on and says this, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jew from some other place. God is not going to let his people get wiped out, he's saying. If you're not going to do it, somebody else will. I promise you, I know God's promise to us, and that's that we will never be wiped out. He will save the Jews. But if he does it without you, your place and your father's house will perish. People will forget the name of Esther. They'll never know you were alive. Somebody else is going to step up, and your story is going to disappear from planet Earth. And then he comes back and says this, and who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Hey, Esther, this amazing journey you're on started as you were an orphan and turned into you're the queen of the palace. Do you think that's normal? It's not normal. This is what little girls grow up to be when they're in the streets begging for bread, which is where she started. They don't end up queen of the greatest empire in the world. That's not how the story usually goes, Esther. You have to know that God has been at work in your life. There's been things that are happening. I know you don't think so. I know you feel sorry for yourself sometimes, yanked her out, but God's been in charge of all that. And he has brought you here for a time such as this. This is why he put you in place. How do you know it's not? Take a look at your life. look at your blessings. And this is a cautionary tale to us. Take a look at your life. Look at your blessings. A lot of us think we're not blessed. A lot of us think we've been scrambling all our lives just to get by. A lot of us think that, you know, this hasn't been good. You know, my life kind of sucks, to be honest with you. But look, take a good look at your life. And oftentimes, if you really take an honest look at your life, you know, you will see God's hand at work in ways that you forgot about. And he's brought it all together for a time such as this. You know, we get to complaining sometime, you know, because we're working so hard. You know, I got two jobs and we're doing all this stuff with the church. But you know what? I've come to the point, I love going to visit people in hospitals. You know why? Because I can. Hallelujah, I can. I'm not in the hospital, you know? I mean, I know a lot of people my age and a lot of my classmates, they're not visiting people in hospitals, they're in the hospital. And there's people with horrible situations. And I've been greatly blessed. You know, God's blessed me with all kind of wonderful things. How do I know that this all hasn't worked together for a time such as this? See, we like to think back. We say, well, you know, but Esther kind of had it easy because she was a beautiful woman. And we know beautiful women who are taught how to seduce. They get anything they want in life, you know. Boy, it must have been easy for her. Sure, you know, she was a woman, an orphan, a Jew, and a captive in the king's court. Four strikes, by the way. Because in that culture, a woman was nothing. They were like chattel. And an orphan, even in the Jewish culture, orphans were hard off. And Jews, well, we see how well they're liked. And she's literally stuck in the king's court. It's not like she can go and come. Why do you think she's sending messengers to Mordecai? She can't go down there. She's a captive. She's a beautiful bird in a gilded cage. That's not a great place to be. And what Mordecai is asking her to do is something that's probably about 80% chance she's going to end up in her death. And besides, she worked to get here. You know, it wasn't Mordecai who had to go and find the favor of the eunuchs. It wasn't Mordecai who had to suppress how she really felt about the Persians while she was learning the Persian culture. It wasn't Mordecai who had to walk into the king with a smile on her face even though she wanted to run in fear from the guy. That wasn't Mordecai who did all that. She did all that. And she got to the top. She struggled and clawed her way to the top. She could have said, you know what, Mordecai, you know, I got here through my work, not yours. And I'm not going to risk it now. I'll be fine. Don't worry. I can talk to the king for me if it gets to that. And so we look at Esther and we say, well, boy, she had this great head start on us. But she doesn't. She's got a four-time loser resume. There's no way she should be able to accomplish anything with that kind of a resume. Well, she was better, I guess, in a better time then if she's able to do this because, you know, she gets to talk to the king and all that. Yeah, that was a great time. It was a corrupt ruling class, absolute power in the government. All the laws were fear-based. Corrupt officials were in power. A totally immoral society. Think about that. If a word came out, I don't care how you feel about anybody, you know, pick the person you hate, the type of person you hate most in the world, and a word came out to you in a letter that on December 13th you can kill them. Would you? I'm hoping not. I'm hoping no matter how bad things get in our politics that no one, you know, for the red state would kill the blue states or vice versa. I'm hoping. You know, what kind of a person would do that? Well, they had people willing to do that. Hey, on December 13th, kill the Jews. Yeah, okay. That'd be great. That's a corrupt and immoral society, and they completely hated the Jews. How'd you like to be in that situation? Hey, some of us are in that situation. You work a place where they hate Christians? Yeah. Do you have an immoral boss? You know, we can identify with Esther. She's facing the same things we're facing. And when you're sitting thinking, well, I can't do anything, you know, Esther was thinking the same thing. Because she had overcome impossible odds to become queen. Why would she jeopardize that now? Well, here's why. Because when Mordecai said, God brought you here for a time such as this, although he doesn't say God, he probably did in for real, but it's not in the book. But he says, you were brought here for a time such as this. Here's what Esther knows. Because she was schooled in Jewish law, that everything that comes to us comes from God. Psalms 75 says this, for promotion comes neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south. God is the judge. He puts one down and exalts another. Esther, you didn't get there by your hard work. You may have worked hard, but it was only the grace of God that you were there. It was only the grace of God. It was God's favor that accomplished that for you. Where has God's favor brought you in your life? It may not be saving, you know, people from genocide. God, I hope there's no one who has to step up and do that. But there are other things we need to step up for, you know? So maybe we're in a breach for our family. maybe for our marriage, maybe for our kids, maybe for our school. Maybe God's calling you to government work. Maybe God's calling you to a ministry. Maybe God is saying, I have given you everything you need to accomplish this. I need you to step up because I did it all for a time such as this. You know, great things happen when people step up for a time such as this. But listen, one good person can accomplish nothing in a corrupt society. And I hate to tell you, ours is getting there fast. The good news is, one obedient person in hands of one true God can literally change the world. For what has God prepared you? What blessings has he given you for a time such as this? Are you willing to step forward and say like Esther did? Because here's what Esther does next. Her next message to Mordecai is this: fast, pray. Have all the people you know fast and pray. And I'm going to do likewise. We're going to align our hearts with the heart of God. And I'm going to ask him, is this why I'm here? And if it is here, I'm going to ask him, show me what to do. And when she does that, again, we don't know because this takes place off stage. But when she does that, God comes and says, this is exactly why I brought you here. And I have a plan. And what you'll see in the next part of the story, which we're not going to get to today, is that her plan doesn't even make sense. That's how you know it came from God. And yet everything falls perfectly for it. And it's one of the most brilliant traps that's ever been sprung in the Bible. For a time such as this, because she took the moment to say, Mordecai's right. I have a lot of blessings. I do. And I'm going to ask God, did you bring me here for a purpose? And if it is, then I'm going to go forward. And here's what she says when she says, I'm going to go to the king. She says, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to the king. And if I perish, I perish. I'm going to step out on faith. And if I die, I die. Because I'm not going to let God down. That person will change the world. The question is, can you be that person? Would you all please pray with me?